Sometimes nature throws us for a loop. This place, for example, beyond the natural beauty of the Baltic region, this place is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. We're at Curonian Spit National Park, and today we're going to find out what makes this place so unique. Moving sands, dancing trees, birds, bridges, a creation of the Baltic Sea's winds and waves, a unique place seemingly out of a fairy tale, and rightfully a UNESCO World Heritage Site. But global warming may change it beyond recognition. Geologist and geographer Irina Zhukovskaya is the right person to talk to about the Curonian Spit National Park. Thank you for taking the time to bring us out here. I have to say that it's going to be a hard time convincing my mom and family that I actually work for a living with a setting like this. So here on the Curonian Spit, we have arid, dry deserts. We have sand dunes. We have rich forests, and we have the beach. What do we owe this great diversity to?
Many specialists call the Curonian Spit a coastal plain. However, it's characterized by unique landscapes formed by sea and wind. The landscape of the Curonian Spit and the small-scale climate events that occur here won't be encountered anywhere else. As a result, you can see open white sand dunes, green forests, birch trees, aspens, and even field of lichens. You will only see it here. The sand we're walking on often sings. It comes from particles of sand rubbing against each other, and you can make it happen with your feet. This is very fine, well-rounded silica sand. When its particles rub against each other, you often hear a rustle, a screech, or even a squeal. If you dance on the sand of the Curonian Spit, you'll be dancing to your own tune.
Now, I know that the wind is always blowing and the sand is very fine, so sand dunes don't stay in one place. How fast do they move and how do they change through time?
Previously, there was no forest on the Spit. There was sand that stretched across the whole area. Today we can see the long Great Dune Ridge, which is composed of the same fine sea sand. When the sand moves at speed exceeding 7 meters per second, the sand particles jump in the air and fly around above the dunes in a constant stream. When the wind dies down, the sand particles settle or roll off the steep slope of the dunes into the bay. But that's the open white sands. What you see here is the foredune, the protective beach dune ridge. This dune ridge was built by humans in the 19th century over the course of several decades. It protected saplings planted on the path plain from flying sand. That forest kept growing, and today this dune ridge provides protection against flying sand and sea waves. What we see is a stable ridge about 8 to 15 meters high. It's covered by vegetation, which means there is no sand transfer. The sand is held together by the roots. But there are other spots which we have to protect.
Now, I know that the Curonian Lagoon is nearby. If the wind is always blowing the sand towards the lagoon, does that mean someday that lagoon will dry up and just be filled with sand?
Of course not. The lagoon has a vast area that's several orders of magnitude greater than the area of remaining white sands. These sands may be transferred and end up in the lagoon, but they are still confined to the surf zone, just a few meters. This sand can only raise the lagoon floor by a few meters.
So one thing that I've noticed while we're out here is that there are all these signs, don't walk off the path, stay on the pathway. Why is that?
Because the Curonian Spit is almost entirely covered by sand rather than soil, vegetation here is very fragile. If you get off the boardwalk at the Eco Trail and just walk along a path a couple of times there and back, it may be enough to ruin it. Then, wind will set to work blowing the sand away and creating a large passage.
So, I understand that is to protect erosion. What else are you doing to protect this park from erosion and generally?
Okay. Let me show you. See the slope here? It's one of the techniques we use to stabilize and anchor sand. When sand comes in from the sea, dries up and begins to move, it gets caught by these intertwined branches. This helps make sure that the foredune is growing and is covered by vegetation. If vegetation fails to grow on the slope in one season, we plant so-called beach grass, the main species being beech pea. We collect seeds right here and plant them on the slope to keep it covered by plants.
Very cool. Thank you for taking the time to show us this and for preserving this for future generations.
Pine groves are also known for holding together sandy soils, and one of them has become especially popular on the Curonian Spit.
Maria, thank you for bringing us out here. This is truly a pleasure. We're in the so-called dancing forest. What makes these trees dance?
The reason for the distortion of the trunks is still unknown. We're trying to research this phenomenon. The best version biologists have come up with has to do with a parasite, the pine shoot moth. The wintering caterpillar of the moth eats buds, thus damaging new growth. After a terminal bud is destroyed, side shoots begin to develop, which results in an unusual twist of the tree.
So how long has this forest been dancing and been twisting like this? And do new trees, when they come up, do they start to deform as well?
The forest is 62 years old at the moment. It was planted in 1961. Given that the wintering caterpillar of the pine shoot moth prefers young trees aged between 10 and 20 years, this forest has been deformed for over 30 years. We, the National Park, have done our own forestry experiment, where we planted young trees from our own nursery here and observed their growth. The trees, however, would get weak, dry out, and die within 4 or 5 years. The cause, again, unknown. We don't know why.
So I know that here at the Dancing Forest, there are a lot of legends. People come up with their own crazy ideas as to why these trees dance. What's your favorite?
My favorite legend is about a coven of young witches. They are said to have frozen in the middle of a dance, turning into these twisted pines.
Thank you very much.
Millions of birds fly over the Curonian Spit in the fall and spring. It's sort of a bird bridge used for feeding and sleeping as they migrate south. That's why the world's first ornithological station was established here almost a century ago to study bird migration.
Andrei, thank you very much for meeting us out here, taking
the time. Nice to meet you here.
So this is a unique place. It's very interesting to me. Tell me what this is and what do you do here?
That's our field site where we study bird migration. And the main method to study bird migration here in our field site, that's banding. So we put a ring on bird's leg and then let them go. But before putting any device, tracking device, ring or satellite transmitters, first we need to trap birds. So that's here you may see our big final trap, which we use to trap birds. And birds, usually the small passerine birds, our specialization in general is the small passerine birds, they do not fly too high. Usually they fly just above the top of the trees. And our trap let us trap birds using this device to trap birds, and then we ring them.
So what kind of birds do you find here? Are there any species that are unique to this area?
Most of the birds, they're not unique, but there is a species that's a sea eagle. That's a huge eagle with a white tail. It's a red book species in our region. They breed in the Curonian Spit. It's a common bird here. But, of course, we don't trap them. They're too big and they fly too high over our nets.
Now, we know that you track the migration patterns. What about global warming? How does that affect the birds and their migration patterns?
Oh, of course, it has an effect. It has an impact on the bird migration. And just the simple example, that's a story with early arrivals of the great teats. That's a small passerine bird. And we realized not only our station, that's all through the Europe, people realized that birds started arriving earlier and earlier. But it doesn't mean that the bird could feel the temperature in the region. In our region, being somewhere in Spain, for example. No, of course not. It's just a natural selection. Great teats, they feed their nestlings with small caterpillars. That's very nutritional food. And early arrivals, they have preferences because the peak of the caterpillars was shifted towards the early dates because of the global warming. Flowering, appearing on the leaves on the trees, shifted the peak earlier. So those of teats who arrived earlier, they have a preference. Those who arrived later, they, of course, they do not have preferences. So they feed later arrivals, they feed their nestlings with less nutritional food, with beetles, and survival rate of the nestlings on their nest, of course, lower. And it means that natural selection works towards those who arrived earlier.
Something you can actually measure. Now, you mentioned banding.
Banding, yeah.
So the birds that you capture here, they get these aluminum rings.
Yep.
Can you show me?
Sure. So, that's a bird.
Mm-hmm.
These are rings. That's a common ring we use here. So I take a ring out of that wire. It has a gap here.
Mm-hmm.
So we just put a ring on bird's leg like this, and I slightly press it. So it's aluminium, that's soft material.
Mm-hmm.
Ring has to, it has to move,
mm-hmm.
so not to disturb birds.
Mm-hmm.
It has a unique number, 2 letters and 5 digits,
mm-hmm.
and just one word as an address. It's a Moscow.
Mm-hmm.
So anywhere, anybody in Europe will retrap this bird with a ring. He or she will read Moscow written in Latin. And of course, it will recognize that the bird was ringed in Russia.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then they have to send the request to Russian Ring Center, our colleagues from Ring Center, by the number they defined that the bird was ringed here.
Mm-hmm.
And they will send us a request to give them all the data we record here now.
Yeah.
So I may release it.
Yeah, please, feel free.
Or if you want, you may release it.
I may?
Yeah, you may.
Okay.
But so just your fingers like this.
Uh-huh.
But like this.
Uh-huh.
No, keep your fingers slightly, not the squeeze, but like, like, yeah.
Okay.
And then let it go.
Okay, like this?
Yeah.
And you said that there's a way to tell when it's ready to go.
Just release it when you want. And maybe you will hear the thanks from the bird.
Okay, here we go.
If you're lucky.
All right, here we go. Whoa. Right now we're going on a scientific expedition to study maritime heritage, ecology of the region, and how climate change is affecting the Baltic Sea. Katja, thanks for taking us out here so that we can have the opportunity to see you work and how you work. Today is not a good example, but the Baltic is known for its ferocious storms. With climate change, my guess is these extreme events are going to start happening more and more. Are you seeing this in your research?
Yeah, actually, the storm activity is becoming more severe nowadays. Actually, the last 10, 20 years, it's became more aggressive and severe, so we're actually now losing our coast for this storm activity. So yeah, unfortunately it is.
That's my next question about losing the coast. Climatologists say that within the next 60 years or so, we're going to see the sea rise at least by a meter. Does that mean these white beaches that we're used to seeing on the Kronian Spit in the Baltic Sea region are going to be lost?
Not specifically for the due to this reason, because luckily for us, Baltic Sea is divided from the rest of the world ocean via the Danish Straits. They are shallow, so we're sort of in our own ecosystem. But yes, our coast is going down due to the geological reasons, because the entire coast of Poland, Germany and Russia in this part of the Baltic Sea experiences transgression processes, and Scandinavia, on the contrary, rises to the skies.
Fishermen refer to this as a lake instead of a sea. First of all, why is that? And but we do know that the salinity of the region is dropping. Why is this, and what effect will that have on the climate?
I will not say that salinity is like dropping or going down really rapid. So it's a slow process. Baltic Sea has two layers, upper brackish one and deep one more saline. So the deep one still is more saline, but upper layer is going less brackish and more fresh water over the years, but it's a really slow process. So that's why fishermen tend to call Baltic Sea a lake. Mm-hmm. And then another reason is the fact that our fish species are sort of more are common to fish species that are from lakes because it's a brackish mm-hmm. environment, so it has lower biodiversity.
Mm-hmm. So I guess in our industry, we say we buried the lead here. I should ask you first and foremost, we're on a scientific expedition. What are we doing here?
In this scientific expedition, particularly, we're studying the greenhouse gases in water, and they're soluble in water. So it's carbon dioxide and CH4. So mm-hmm. it's the main greenhouse gases that we're trying to locate in water. So it's our top priority nowadays.
You mentioned greenhouse gases. When I think of greenhouse gases, I think of the atmosphere and the air that we breathe. I don't think of underwater greenhouse gases. What are they? How are they different? And how do you actually track them?
Actually, it's the same greenhouse gases as from in atmosphere and in the ocean, but they can go from atmosphere to the ocean and from the ocean to the atmosphere. So it's an unending cycle between hydrosphere, atmosphere, and actually lithosphere. So mm-hmm. All these gases can be get through the phytoplankton, zooplankton, and go into bottom sediments mm-hmm. and so into lithosphere. So they're the same, CH4, carbon dioxide. So it's no difference, but our world ocean and seas, they are actually nowadays saving us through the taking excessive carbon dioxide from the atmosphere into the water and then into bottom sediments.
I guess my devil's advocate question is, how do you combat greenhouse gases in the ocean, and is there an actual need to do so?
There are two types of gases in the ocean. First one is that gases that came from the atmosphere, and that's why we don't fight them in the ocean, actually. It's better to fight them from the very start, from the very beginning, from our plants, from our cars, from humanity itself. And the second part is those gases like CH4, which came from organic rich bottom sediments. Mm-hmm. And they are going into the water from bottom sediments. And in this point, they're also sort of unbearable in this situation because it's a natural cause. It's not mm-hmm. human impact.
Right.
So it's hard to mitigate.
It's all connected, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't want to keep you from your work any longer, so we'll let you get back to it. But thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you very much.
So, Leila, thank you for taking the time to meet us out here, or take us out here, really. I know that you are a climatologist yourself, but you have interesting experience with maritime cultural heritage. So the Baltic is known as the Sea of Sunken Ships. Why so many shipwrecks out here, and how has it gotten this reputation?
The Baltic Sea is relatively small, and it's also a semi-enclosed sea, which means it suffers from a great deal of human activity, intense sea traffic, fishing, offshore oil and gas production, the construction of canals, etc. So, of course, all the objects we find underwater, at the bottom of the sea, are a result of human activity, both now and in the past. I should also mention that the Baltic Sea is cold, with significant freshwater inflow. This creates a perfect environment for the preservation of these underwater wreck sites, allowing them to last for a very long time. Besides, the naval shipworm, known as Pterido navalis, isn't really found in the Baltic Sea. It's an organism that destroys wooden ships, and that's why we have so many well-preserved shipwrecks. Finally, another big factor is the legacy of World War II. After the war, some of the ships loaded with chemical weapons were intentionally sunk here in the Baltic Sea.
My understanding is that a shipwreck that has even been down there maybe 100 years has an effect on the ecology of the Baltic system. Is this true? And what can we do about it?
This is not entirely true, because wooden ships don't typically harm the environment. But the vessels that were scuttled carrying chemical weapons or ships loaded with fuel could certainly have an impact on the ecosystem. These are older ships, and the chemicals leaking into the environment could cause irreparable damage. If we're talking about fuel, then it's absolutely a threat. But in case of mustard gas, which is denser than water, it will mostly drift along the seabed, gradually diffusing. But nevertheless, it could also do irreversible harm to the ecology.
So it seems to me there's also a paradox. If it's too dangerous and too expensive to go down and actually clean up a shipwreck, and this shipwreck will be poisoning the Baltic, what can we do about it? What type of solutions are there?
The problem with recovering sunken ships isn't even the costs, but rather the matter of safety. Like I said, these ships are quite old, and the munition shells they carry are corroding and getting thinner. It is much safer to leave them as is, because mustard gas, which is obviously very dangerous, is also a very dense gas, so it will do less damage if released gradually into the environment. Lifting the wreckage up and disturbing the metal would do more harm. Therefore, the best option is probably not to disturb the wreckage and leave it be. As for wooden ships, there is a different sort of challenge there. They are incredibly hard to preserve once on land, exposed to the atmosphere. When the environment changes, they immediately start breaking down. These ships remain preserved in cold and moderately salty water for a long time. Keeping a wooden ship recovered from the bottom of the sea is a massive challenge. So it's always a hard question whether the ship is really worth recovering.
Now, when I think of shipwrecks, I think of a lot of things. Pirates, I think of scuba diving. But for me, I'm interested, what's been the most exciting discovery for you recently?
2 years ago, an expedition of ours found a ship about 50 meters long and 7 meters wide. We found it at a depth of about 26 meters. It was a science and education expedition, and in fact, it was a female student from one of our local universities who found the ship while on watch. The vessel itself had not been previously identified. Later, upon investigation, it turned out to be a French fishing boat sunk by a Soviet pilot. He was never awarded the ship as a trophy, however. This was probably a bit of a surprise for many people, but not for us who study the sea and deal with maritime heritage. It really is a misconception that the sea is now small, that every nook and cranny has been explored. It's actually far from that, and we continue to find pieces of the past on the seabed.
Very cool. Now, if you don't mind me asking, not just shipwrecks, but also from a climatologist perspective, does it bring you joy to know that you're out here making a difference and trying to save the world, really?
There's this feeling that climatologists, paleoclimatologists, experts in climate modeling, nothing to do with fashion, I'm talking about people who design predictive models of climate change, there is a feeling that we can actually have an impact on our future, on the future of our children. I know it might sound a bit dramatic, but it feels like we're saving the planet, that we are part of this collective effort, that we can influence and change the world around us, at least when it comes to the ocean and the sea.
Thank you for taking the time to talk to me. I'll let you get back to work.
Thank you.